Thank you, Barbara. So I'd like to thank the organizers for the kind of invitation to be here. And Bill, I was planning to sing Happy Birthday to you, but you said you're celebrating your retirement and not your birthday. I'll sing for you. Yeah? No. So at some point you guys will feel pity and will join in, right? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Bill. Happy birthday to you. Well, I figured if I start a low point, my talk can only move upward. All right, so I will be presenting work that is done jointly with Dan Slepchev, who is one of the postdocs at the University of Toronto. It's been a pleasure to work with him. He's finishing up his postdoc this year and will be moving out into the big wide world, and he is someone to be paying attention to. So what we worked on was exact solutions of a particular problem in fluid mechanics, and what you should be thinking of is painting the ceiling. And so what you have is you have a flat surface. There we go. So you have a flat solid, you have a flat surface and you have a liquid hanging from that flat surface. So the blue represents a liquid, and the thickness of the liquid at a point x and at a time t is represented by u of xt. So the thickness is a function of space and of time. And as I've drawn it right now, I've drawn it as if we live in a two-dimensional world and all ceilings are lines. In fact, if the ceiling was parameterized by x and y, then the thickness of the film would be a function of x and y and t. So you have a thin film which is modeled by this function u, and where u is positive, you have fluid, and where u is negative, you have a dry surface. In the physics of the situation, if you have painted your ceiling, you have two real forces going on. One is the force of surface tension, which wants to minimize the amount of area of fluid which is exposed to air. So if surface tension was all that was going on, the film would want to be completely flat, because that would minimize the air-liquid interface. On the other hand, there's a competing force, which is the force of gravity, which would like all of the paint to fall off the ceiling and into your hair. In the process of doing that, the air-liquid interface would in no way be flat, and in fact it would be lengthening. And so you have a competition between two effects, surface tension and gravity. Now, if you assume that this fluid is very viscous, then you can model the fluid flow with Stokes' equation. And if you assume that the film is quite thin and it doesn't have great irregularities in it, any big derivatives of the surface as a graph, then you can do asymptotic approximations of Stokes' equation, and you find a fourth order partial differential equation that models the motion of the air-liquid interface as a function of time. Yes? I'm sorry, what? Yes, that's going to show up. It's a question of whether you've painted the ceiling or painted the floor. And that's going to show up, and it's going to show up in this sign right here. Okay, so this is a fourth-order equation. And the reason you have four derivatives is because Stokes' equation has two derivatives, and you have this, that the pressure jump from liquid to air is proportional to curvature of the interface, and when you compute the curvature, you're going to pick up an extra two derivatives. So this fourth order term right here reflects the forces of surface tension. The second order term reflects what Stefanella brought up, which is that it actually depends whether you've painted the ceiling or painted the floor. This reflects the force of gravity. And if you have a plus sign, then this second order term is a regularizing term. So in fact, if you had that plus sign and you didn't have the fourth order term, you would have something that could be like a porous medium equation or a heat equation or something, depending on what g is. So if this is a plus sign, you've painted the floor, and gravity and surface tension are working in concert, and you get a flat surface. If this is a minus sign, then gravity and surface tension are at odds, and you can get interesting structures in the long time limit. And so the case where they're at odds with each other is when you have is what you call the long wave unstable thin film equation, and it's the case that that Dan and I studied. So that's the equation. And I want to emphasize that when you have a fourth order equation and you're looking for solutions that start out non-negative and remain non-negative for all time, it is not obvious that arbitrary fourth order equations are going to preserve that non-negativity. And there's actually some subtlety hidden in these equations that will stop your fluid from penetrating into your ceiling. Also, these types of equations model other scenario. If you put oil into a skillet and then put the skillet on the burner, you know that you get structures in the oil from where the burners are. That's because surface tension depends on temperature. Those types of effects can be modeled by equations like this. If you put a fluid into a pipe, so you just have a long pipe and there's a little puddle of fluid in it, the effect of curvature in this direction actually causes an instability. And you can model this by equations like that. And that's especially interesting because the way the instability manifests itself in the pipe case is that you can actually get that the fluid leaps up and bridges the cross-section of the pipe, which, if you're talking about the pipe being a lung and the fluid being the slime inside of your lungs, that instability would correspond to occluding a breathing passage. So anyway, these equations show up in a lot of places. So a number of years ago, Andrea Bertozzi and I approached these equations, and we wanted to know whether it was possible to choose the exponents. So here what I've done is I've chosen particular choices for F and for G, and I have committed myself to a negative sign there, so I have an instability, and I have these two terms are competing with each other. And Andrea Bertozzi and I were wondering if it is possible for the lower order term to be so strong that it overwhelms the higher order term. And this is a fourth order analog of the semilinear heat equation with a reaction term, where if the reaction term is strong enough, you can actually get a finite time singularity from this, that the competition between reaction and diffusion. What we wanted to know is, what is the relation between the nonlinearity in the second order term and the nonlinearity in the fourth order term, which could allow the fourth order term to lose out to the second order term if you have initial data which is sufficiently extreme. And so that was the question. And the reason we asked a question like that is because when a modeler writes down an equation like this, they would like to know whether the solution stays within the regime of validity that they were considering when they wrote down their model. And so if you've started out by assuming that you have a thin film and you write down an equation where at some point and at some time the film is getting thicker and thicker and thicker, then you had better go and look at the physics of your system again. Either your equation is... So we came up with a naive little scaling argument, which I can show in under 2 minutes, but I will give you the punchline now. The punchline was that there's a regime which you see you would need if you want to have finite time blow up. So if you want a film to be able to become infinitely thick at some point in a finite time, you would need that the nonlinearity, which has this exponent m, would have to have the m is greater than or equal to n plus 2. No. It's actually a really sweet little argument, and I'd be thrilled to show it to you if you would be willing to stand still long enough. It's really nice. One thing that is important is that you have mass conservation. So if you were looking for blow-up in something like a Kahn-Hilliard equation with a reaction term, you would get a different prediction. The mass preservation is quite important. So we came up with a conjecture which basically was saying that there's a subcritical regime, so if m is sufficiently small, then all solutions will be bounded for all time. And then we defined a critical and a supercritical regime. So the critical regime is when you have equality, and the supercritical regime is when you have the inequality. And numerical simulations suggested that in both the critical and in the supercritical regime, you can find initial data which will focus in at a point and blow up at that point with a finite time blow up. And the simulation suggested that the blow up was in a self-similar manner. So the length scale and the height scale related to each other in a easily found algebraic form. For the special case of n equals 1, in the n equals 1 case, that was the nonlinearity on the fourth order term. If that nonlinearity is just u rather than u to the nth power, various miracles happen that allow one to prove that finite time singularities occur using a variance, an argument having to do with the variance of the solution. And that argument was formally suggested by Andy Bernoff. And so for n equals 1, you can actually rigorously prove that in the critical and in the supercritical regimes that solutions of the initial value problem can blow up in finite time. So the background to this is you can view this equation in terms of a gradient flow with respect to an energy. So this fourth order equation dissipates an energy, and this energy is a combination of the line tension and the pressure. So this energy, so you have the integral of the first derivative squared minus some number times the solution to a power. And given this energy, you can, first of all, you can write the evolution equation actually as a gradient flow with respect to this energy. So here I've taken the variation of the energy, differentiated twice, multiplied by a mobility. This has to do with basically with a time scale in some sense, and taken another derivative. Formally, this appears to look like a gradient descent, that the evolution equation is satisfying a gradient descent problem in a space where the inner product depends on the solution at that particular time. Making that rigorous, that's a formal argument. Making this true is completely non-trivial. It can be done for n equals 1, and this is something that Dayan has been doing on his own. Anyway, you have this energy, and it's dissipated in time. And so the energy of the solution at one time is less than or equal to its initial energy, and so you would think that what could possibly go wrong? You're dissipating energy. And the answer to what could go wrong is that if you look at this energy, it has two terms. It has a positive term, and you're subtracting a positive term. And so this energy could be decreasing as a function of time, but it could be going to minus infinity in finite time. And this is where the critical, subcritical, and supercritical regimes will show up. So you have this dissipated energy, and you don't have any control on its sign. In fact, you don't even need control on its sign. If you just knew that it was always bounded below by minus 1,000, that would preclude finite time blow up. In the subcritical regime, where m is less than n plus 2, you can use a Galliard or Nirenberg inequality to find a constant which depends on the mass of the initial data, so that if you add that constant to the energy, that will always be an upper bound for the H1 norm of the solution. So what this tells you is that the energy cannot go to minus infinity, and with a little bit of work, this will also tell you that solutions exist for all time and are bounded for all time. So if m less than n plus 2, Galliard or Nirenberg does the trick. So the subcritical regime is taken care of by Galliard or Nirenberg. In the critical regime, Tom Wutelski, Andy Bernoff, and Andrea Bertozzi found a an inequality that Zsirinagyi had found in 1941 with a sharp constant. And if you use that constant, you find that the energy is bounded below by this quantity times this thing in brackets. If this thing in brackets happens to be positive, then you have found a way of relating the energy dissipation to something that you can relate to an H1 norm. So you would like to know whether that thing in brackets is positive. The thing in brackets is positive. This right here is the mass of the initial data, and the mass is preserved by the evolution. But anyway, this is the mass of the initial data, and what it tells you is that if your initial data has mass which is less than this number, then you're going to have a bound like this, which will ensure that solutions exist for all time. So if you have initial data with sufficiently small mass, solutions will exist for all time, and this then makes you wonder what happens if you have initial data with this mass, what happens if you have initial data with mass greater than this mass. Is this mass important? Or is it just a trick that Zsirinagyi played on us? So here is a computation that I borrowed from Tom Witelski, Bernoff, and Bertozzi. And here what they did is something quite clever. These solutions preserve their support. And so if you take initial data, which is 0, positive, 0, positive, 0, then for some short period of time, this droplet won't know anything about this droplet. And so for some short period of time, this droplet would be living in blissful ignorance of its brother. But then as they spread, they run into each other and they discover each other and things can happen. So what they did was they chose initial data where each droplet has mass less than this MC number, and they took that as initial data. And so what they found is that the initial droplet, it shortens in height, this droplet shortens in height, they both expand in breadth, they appear to be spreading in a self-similar manner, actually. But then they run into each other, and what happens is the moment they run into each other, their cumulative mass was chosen to be greater than this number MC, and the moment they run into each other, they blow up focused at a point. So this was a computation for the n equals 1 case in the critical regime, which is suggestive that the mass is quite important. Okay, so it can't. We have to be a little bit careful in that if their initial data had been steady states, so there exist steady states for these solutions, and if you take two steady states and you just, you know, Nebraska and Iowa, they will just sit there. So no, as long as the initial data is not a steady state radius, a steady initial data, it will spread, and eventually it will run into its. It depends on the exponents m and n. For the critical case, the steady states are not attractive. For other choices of m and n, they are. But yes?
Steady states have compact support, so they really don't sort of grow. I mean, they don't, they're really
disjoint. Yes. So, yes. And so here is the steady state. And it has compact support, it has zero contact angle, and lo and behold, the mass of the steady state is precisely that critical number.
I mean, it doesn't scale.
Well, so then you say, does it scale? And so you ask, okay, if I shrink the support and make the puppy taller, how does its mass change? And it turns out that in the critical regime, if I take that steady state and I make it narrower and taller, I'll get another steady state, but it will still have that mass. Yeah. This is the miracle of the critical regime. So the steady state with zero contact angle has the mass of this magic number, and they're invariant under the natural rescaling. They have zero contact angle. The existence theory for the initial value problem yields solutions that have zero contact angle at almost all times. So Dan and I started looking for self-similar solutions with compact support and zero contact angle. Because you can prove that these solutions have finite speed of propagation, and it's a natural thing to look for. So what you do is you make an ansatz looking for a self-similar solution, and here you assume a temporal scaling, a spatial scaling, and a shape function u, and this number sigma is going to either be plus 1 or minus 1. So if sigma is plus 1, then as time goes to infinity, this is just going to get larger and larger. This is negative, so your solution is getting shorter, and you can check with the spatial scaling, it's getting shorter and fatter. So sigma equals plus 1 corresponds to a self-similar spreading solution. Sigma equals minus 1 corresponds to a solution that blows up at time 1, and it focuses as it blows up. So Elena Beretta proved the existence of source-type solutions. So these are solutions that have sigma equal to plus 1. And so these solutions have compact support, zero contact angle, and they spread in a self-similar manner. And the methods that Dan and I have show that all of these solutions have mass less than mc. So all of the self-similar spreading solutions have mass less than the critical mass. Now, you turn the question to the solutions that blow up in finite time. So here, sigma is equal to minus 1, and you're looking for solutions that blow up at time 1, and they're going to blow up focused at a point. And Witelski, Burnoff, and Bertozzi did extensive numerics and asymptotics on the case where n equals 1. So they looked at the critical regime where you have this nonlinearity, which makes things much nicer for various reasons. And what they did is, so there are two approaches to when you're trying to find these solutions. One is a shooting method, and one is a boundary value problem approach. This was discussed by Dödel a little bit this morning. So what they do is they fix a domain, and they look for the profile of the solution as on that domain, and they give it the freedom it needs to be as tall as it needs to satisfy the ordinary differential equation that the shape function satisfies in that domain. So they fix their domain, and they allow their solution to have whatever height it needs. And what they did was they computed that there's a one-bump profile. So this profile, as it blows up, will get narrower and taller with just one peak. They computationally found a two-bump profile. And here you're going to have two local maxima which move in and blow up. And they found a three-bump profile and so on. Now, there are various things to notice. First of all, the heights of these solutions are getting taller and taller. Another thing to notice is that their heights are awfully close to each other. When they're small, they're very, very small. And in fact, this is actually very close to a solution to a positive periodic steady state. And that is the observation that actually Dan had made in the privacy of his own office a year ago using the MATLAB code, and which is the background to all of our analytical approaches. But anyway, so you have these solutions, they're multi-bump, and this group found that these solutions are linearly unstable. They did that computationally. These solutions are computationally unstable, and the one-bump solution is computationally linearly stable. So what they did was they looked at a specific equation. They found, in fact, that there are infinitely many profiles of this type. If you want a million bumps, they will give you a million bumps. It'll be very tall. But they found that the only one that's linearly stable, the only one that would show up in the generically in the initial value problem, is the one-bump solution. And one of the things that Dayan has done is he has used a very nice way of approaching this problem, rather than using the Eulerian formulation, which is implicit, by writing it this way. He has used a Lagrangian approach to address the linear stability of these profiles, and he's proven that these profiles are actually linearly unstable. Okay, here is a bifurcation diagram because I feel there has to be one at this meeting. Here, this is again from Witelski, Burnoff, and Bertozzi. Here they're actually using the length as a bifurcation parameter, that corresponds to keeping the height fixed, which is something you would do in a shooting method approach to this problem. And what they find is that you can have solutions that blow up at time one only if they're sufficiently short, and that as they get shorter, their mass goes to the mass of the droplet steady state. These bifurcations, these diagrams correspond to the two bump profile, and its mass is converging to the mass of two steady droplets, and so on. Okay, so let me quickly finish by just giving you an inkling of how things are done. So our approach is not to use a boundary value problem approach, but to view this as a shooting problem. And so in a shooting problem, you take the ODE that the shape function has to satisfy, you pick a height, you make the assumption that the slope is zero, and then you play around with the second derivative, trying to find a second derivative so that when you touch down with zero contact angle. So you have one parameter to play with, and you're trying to find a magical parameter so it touches down with zero contact angle. This assumed that the solutions are symmetric. If you want to allow yourself solutions that are not symmetric, you would have to allow this first derivative to be a tunable parameter, and that to be a tunable parameter, and you would be simultaneously tuning two parameters, trying to find a zero contact angle touchdown here, and then over on the other side a zero contact angle touchdown there, which was more than we had the stomach for, so we took symmetric solutions, but we would welcome suggestions from people who have experience with two-parameter shooting problems. So the thing that we have a number of qualitative results. One qualitative result is that any solution that blows up in finite time in a self-similar manner with zero contact angles must have initial mass greater than the critical mass. And the way this is proven is by a comparison to the steady state solutions. So the steady state equation is autonomous. It's exactly the same as the solution that the shape profile satisfies, except that it's missing one term. And all of our methods, so the shape profile has this non-autonomous term. If you didn't have that there, that would be the equation that a steady state satisfies. For the mass result, what we do is we relate the initial value problem for the shape profile U to an initial value problem for the steady state problem. And you can prove a pointwise comparison result where they both have the exact same initial data, but if they have the exact same initial data, the self-similar profile would have to sit pointwise below the steady state droplet profile. It would have zero contact angle. You can prove that. And then it follows that if you're going to have something which is a profile with non-zero contact angle, it must sit outside of a steady state profile. And this gives you the comparison result. But the key thing is that we were able to relate the shape profile to a steady state profile. And for the existence results, we have the existence of self-similar of profiles that blow up in finite time for as many bumps as you want. But the key idea is that all of our existence results involve being able to trap the self-similar profile that we can control the self-similar profile by relating it to solutions that are steady states. And this type of control, where we're basically using the fact that the solutions are close to steady states, then allow us to make the intricacies of the shooting method work. It gets a little bit nasty because what you're trying to do is trying to argue that this term doesn't really matter that much, because that's the difference between the steady state and the self-similar solution, which can be nasty because this is not necessarily a positive number. So this term could in fact be blowing up near a touchdown point. But I will stop and just say thank you.